Thank you, Your Honor, but I pray I won't need it.
Well, did your red brief give away your case on claim construction?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Did your red brief give away your case on claim construction?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The fact is that there is no requirement for independent manipulation. There's no requirement for out having access. The specification makes that clear. We never gave it away. It has to be separate. We don't deny that it has to be separate, but it is separate. The question is, what does separate mean? If you listen to Mr. Powers, he takes it bit by bit. He says, if all you have is a single bit, how can it be separate from any other bit? But that isn't what we're talking about. We're talking about separate metacode map, separate from mapped content. And if you can envisage a bowl of jelly beans, and you had yellow jelly beans and blue jelly beans, and they were all mixed together, then Mr. Powers' point might have some significance or value. But if you have the bowl divided so that you have a mass of blue jelly beans here and a mass of yellow jelly beans here, they are separate. And that is the whole concept. The fact is that Your Honors have focused correctly on Figure 9. You can also focus on Figure 7, which also shows that the user has access at the same time to both the map content and the metacode map. And you can also look at the very top, oval 132, input device for creating content and selecting metacodes. The user has access to both. And it's not only the Figure 9 statement that has the statement about updating, but if you look at column 6, lines 14 and 15, the map content area and metacode map is updated as changes are made.
Okay, I'm a little slower than you're going right now. Go back to figure 7. What is it about figure 7 that shows me the user has access to both?
At the very, if you look at figure 7, you'll see oval 132, input device for creating content and selecting metacodes, meaning the user has access, knowledge of both. Their point is it's got to be without access, it's got to be without knowledge. They mentioned that multiple times in the brief. And a question was asked about the file history, and Mr. Powers focused on the wrong words. Judge Moore, I think you focused on the right words. If you read the statement at 2796, it says, this separation allows distinct processes to operate on the content and the architecture with or without knowledge of the other. Now, the next sentence, which Mr. Powers focused on, he said, you didn't look at the next sentence, but the next sentence starts with, in other words, meaning it's a summary of what precedes it. And all it says is, in other words, using the present invention, one could change. It's permissive. It's not mandatory. Every embodiment in the specification has automatic updating. When you update the metacode map, when you change the metacode map, you automatically update.
You mean synchronization?
Yes, it's synchronization. And in fact, it is interesting because Microsoft has flip-flopped. In its main brief, it said at blue 32, because a change to one of the metacode map or map content, those are added words from the preceding sentence, requires a change to the other, the alleged metacode map and map content in Word 203 and Word 207 cannot be independently manipulated. Their independent manipulation charge is tied to this automatic updating, and they say that can't be done. Then they get to their gray brief, and they do an about-face. They realize they've got a problem. And so here they say, independent manipulation by a user...
What page are you on the gray brief?
Mr. Donner, what page in the
gray
brief?
What page is 4, gray 4. Independent manipulation by a user is not inconsistent with automatic updating by the system. That's a total flip-flop. And I submit, Your Honors, that in fact, to follow Microsoft's claim construction would be to read out preferred embodiments in the specification. That's impermissible under multiple decisions of this court. I'd like to go on to the invalidity point.
Can we do inducement first? Mr. Powers focused on that. Let me just ask you a process question. If we, in order to uphold the damages and the injunction, do we have to find that Microsoft induced and contributorily infringed, or would it be sufficient to find one or the other?
Your Honor, under Microsoft's theory, you need to do both. Under our theory, you need to do only one. And let me answer that by going to that point right now. And that is, they argue that there was an incorrect jury instruction using the word component instead of material and apparatus, which are the words of 271C. And they say, under the law, if there is if one of the legal theories is erroneous, then you've got to throw out the case, even if the other theory is. Our point is that the bad instruction, if it is a bad instruction, was totally harmless. It's totally harmless because the only reason they give for prejudice to them is that software might have infringed component but doesn't infringe material or apparatus. Well, Lucent versus Microsoft put that question to rest because 271C was involved, software was involved. They made the same arguments there that they have made in this case, and the court found infringement under 271C and for software. So the only prejudice that they allege for the bad instruction is something that is not a viable prejudice. Moreover, there is no reasonable way, I submit, that the jury could have been affected by the use of the word component rather than material or apparatus, because that debate was never in front of the jury. That debate was only before the judge on jury instructions. What the jury heard was testimony where Dr. Rhine said he used the word component or apparatus. He actually commingled the two. The RICO case commingles the two. It talks about a component in a software process situation, 271C. And so the point is that there can't be any prejudice here. The jury instruction was totally harmless. It can't be a basis for remand for a new trial. And therefore, all you need to find is 271B or 271C. That was a long answer to your very short question. I apologize. It is our position that both 271B and 271C are satisfied in this case. And while I'm talking about that, let me talk about that issue. I'm jumping out of the order that I would give, but I long since learned answer questions immediately and not defer them.
So the issue being the inducement and the argument
yes,
Mr. Powers
yes.
made with respect to knowledge of Microsoft of the past.
Yes. Okay. We'll talk about intent and then whether or not there are substantial non-infringing uses. Those are the two points he made. There is more than this is, I agree totally with Judge Moore. It doesn't make any difference whether I agree with Judge Moore, but she has the final decision. But in this case, I do agree that this is a fact, it's a fact question. And there was ample evidence here for the jury to have found intent under either 271B or 271C for over a three-year period from 2001 through 2004. There were dealings where the details of the I4I system were explained, where it was repeatedly explained, it was patented. Microsoft gave instructions to its users as to how to use their XML editor in a way that would have infringed. The testimony says that would have infringed. There are documents, Microsoft documents, saying that they're going to obsolete I4I system. This was a former partner, in Microsoft's own words, an aggressive attempt to actually eliminate I4I as a competitor from the system. I submit, under those circumstances, particularly the DSU case, which is a 271B case, which arguably has a higher standard of intent, it basically says that you have a duty. You don't need to know that the actions would induce infringement. You should have known that the actions would induce infringement. And in the in situ form case, which we also cite, they talk about active or constructive knowledge.
But I guess Mr. Power's argument, as I understand it, is knowledge of a patent number is not the same thing as knowledge of the patent.
Your Honor, we describe the patent as covering, the patent covered the process they were hearing.
S4 technology, is that right? S3, S4, or something like that?
Pardon, Your Honor?
I think the email said something like the S4, it covers the S4 technology.
So we said it covered the process. At the very least, they had a duty to disclose, particularly in a situation where you have an aggressive company with a lot of market power concluding it's going to obsolete its competitor's process. And in fact, they did obsolete it in 80% of the market.
Well, when you said duty to disclose, did you mean they had a duty to investigate?
Duty to investigate. I misspoke. The point is...
Well, wait a minute. In the willfulness context, I mean, didn't we sort of get rid of this duty to investigate to some extent? Why would we now
give it
vitality through 271B or C?
Because Broadcom holds that the rules as to willfulness do not apply in an indirect infringement context. And so that's exactly right. In the willfulness context, Seagate says you don't have a duty to investigate. That is not true, we submit, in an indirect infringement context. Now, unless there are more questions of that, I'd like to go to the substantial non-infringing use. There are three alleged substantial non-infringing uses, and the Vitamix case is very instructive, the recent Vitamix case, because it basically tells you that it gives you sort of a benchmark. I hate to use the word benchmark because it comes up in another context, as to when it is infringing or not infringing, or whether it's substantial or not. And it talks about, it cites two different cases. It talks about utility, presence, and efficiency of the non-infringing use. And alternatively, it talks about whether the alleged non-infringing use is unusual, far-fetched, impractical, aberrant, or experimental. And there were three non-infringing uses, and Dr. Ryan addressed his comments to all three, and he concluded that they were all three non-infringing, and I will explain why his testimony relates to the Vitamix test. The first one is a case where somebody's working with XML documents with metacodes, but there's no content there. And his conclusion was that the only purpose of doing that is to add content and resulting in infringement. And that, he concluded, was a non-infringing use. The second one was the use is created by XML documents that are never reopened. And Dr. Ryan said that has no relevance to how, in the real world, users use an XML editor. And he concluded that that was not substantial. And that, of course, would be unusual. That would be far-fetched, that would be impractical under these Vitamix tests, and the first one would have been, I submit, far-fetched or impractical. The third one is the one that Mr. Powers focuses on, and that's the one where there were several million, I think there were 2 million pieces of evidence or 2 million events where the XML documents were saved in a binary format, which they call .doc or .dot, and they can't be shared with other systems. And Dr. Ryan pointed out that this contravenes the fundamental purpose, not of the patented invention, but of XML, which is to create a system that can be shared with other systems. So again, this fits into the Vitamix test. It's impractical, it's lacking in utility. So we submit that it's a red herring to argue that there are non-infringing uses here, and moreover, that issue doesn't cut across 271B in any event. 271B would remain viable.
Can I move you to damages before your time runs out? Is Judge Moore...
Oh, I've got plenty of time.
As Judge Moore seemed to suggested to Mr. Powers, I mean, there's for the economists in the room or the consumers, there is a lot of appeal to the notion that you're using as a benchmark a $400 or $500 product when the product of Microsoft Word costs something less than half of that. And what we're talking about is one of many, 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 many components or functions within Microsoft Word. There's something that's intuitively problematic, I would suggest to you, about having done that, about that methodology.
Well, let me explain then why the benchmark was chosen, and as part of that explanation, I hope to answer all of even your intuitive concerns, if they're not real concerns. One is, why was that benchmark chosen? The benchmark was chosen because it was Microsoft's policy to add functionality to Word, to its basic Word system, without charging for it. The one time they charged for it, they charged $50 across all of the Microsoft systems. And if you followed the same methodology of applying the $50 across all XML systems, even though somebody might not have infringed using that XML system, you end up not with a $98 per unit royalty, but with a $2 unit royalty following the same methodology. But
Counsel, you can't use that, though, because you've got to prove infringement of a method patent here, not an apparatus patent, in which case you could look at the $2 per product capable of infringing. But since this is a method patent, and for damages purposes, the only thing you can turn everyone towards is the instances of actual use of the process, because that's the only thing that infringes, We are stuck with the $98 per product royalty. $2 is not on the table.
Let me accept that, Your Honor, and I think our answer is still a viable answer. He picked X-Metal because of the fact that the $50 use that Microsoft added was a very low use. Their practice was not to charge for added functionality to induce people to use their systems. So he decided, rationally, I submit, that he couldn't use the $50 number as an example. So what did he do? He looked for other possibilities. And he found that there were three other possibilities out in the market that Microsoft considered competitors, one of whom was X-Metal. Of the three other possibilities, X-Metal was the cheapest by far of those three possibilities. So that, in turn, additionally, was a rational use. He also considered the possibility of I4I system, and that was a little lower, but they combined with the sale of that system was services, was consulting and what have you. He concluded that the total price would have been more for I4I system, so he decided that the X-Metal system was the best benchmark, and he needed a benchmark. He needed something to start with. Now, he didn't, in answer to...
Why didn't he start with the cost of Word and then figure out how much of the value of Word is attributable to the XML patented technology?
Your Honor, because it was difficult to do that, because Microsoft doesn't charge typically for these added functionalities. So I don't think it was practicable for him to start with Word. He needed to start with an XML add-on.
But you think a $500 software package for XML, which is only a tiny portion of the huge functionality offered by Microsoft Word, isn't a reasonable one-to-one substitute? You think every person that bought and used Microsoft Word for an infringing use would have alternatively bought the $500 XML, X-Metal product as an alternative if Word did not offer that functionality? I mean, that's totally irrational.
He did not include all of the total number of people who had the XML functionality. He only used, based on the survey, the people who in fact he concluded, based on the survey, used XML
functionality. No, that's right. He used everyone who uses XML functionality in Word. But even the people who use XML functionality in a $200 product, how can you suggest that every one of them would have bought a $500 product if they couldn't, right? I mean, simple demand curve. I go to the store, I want a VCR or a Blu-ray DVD player or something like that, and I find out it's $300. I might be willing to pay that. But if I go to the store, the same person willing to pay $300 is not willing to pay $500 for the same thing. I might at that point say, well, I don't need it that bad.
Your Honor, we submit that if a person wanted XML, he used the 25% rule, and then he depreciated that a little after his calculations. We submit that if a person wanted to use XML functionality, and they had choices. They didn't want to buy a whole word system, that they would have been willing, for those who wanted to use it, for those who infringed, which is the only ones that the 2 million total number affects, they would have paid. They
Where's that evidence?
Isn't it a flaw in his methodology, though, to not have asked? I mean, we say we need a survey. You needed a survey. The survey worked with respect to who used it. That was a relevant factor. Yeah. Isn't it equally relevant and necessary to establish that once you've identified the people that use XML on a daily basis, that they would have, in the alternative, gone out and spent a lot of money for just that function in a separate
purchase? Your Honor, that could have been a question that's asked, but I submit to you, I hate to just rely on the fact that this is a sufficiency of evidence standard, but it is. The jury heard all of these arguments. Microsoft made all of these arguments before the jury. Microsoft cross-examined Wagner, cross-examined Wecker, attacked the quality of the survey, attacked the quality of the Georgia Pacific analysis that Wagner made, and the jury accepted the verdict.
Counsel, I don't think that Judge Prost and I are focusing our questions on JMOL because that wasn't raised here. So we can't look at all of this for sufficiency of the evidence. That's off the table. I think we're looking at it under Daubert. Should Wagner have been allowed to offer this testimony, or is his methodology flawed because, you know, he didn't use the right equation? He missed entire variables that should have been in there. Is that methodology so flawed to render it unreliable and therefore inadmissible under cover? I think that's what really the focus of our questions are on, just so you know.
Your Honor, I realize that. I don't think his methodology was flawed. You're suggesting that he might have asked additional questions. I assume that in any survey that's made, somebody can come up with additional questions that might have been asked. It may have even been nice if he had asked these additional questions. But what he did ask, the survey basically was trying to identify people who used the XML editor. And there were 988 surveys out there, 46 responded, 19 were found to have used it. He only used the 19. He assumed that every other one of the 988
but this all goes to a different question. Mr. Dunner, that all of the testimony that you're discussing now goes to how many people use XML technology.
Right.
That doesn't go to whether or not those people would have purchased a $500 alternative, which is the thing that I think our questions are struggling with. The notion that a $500 alternative would have been a one-to-one substitution, and I guess my concern is this a question of methodology or choice of what you're substituting into a formula? And because if it's, in my view, if we just think he made the wrong choice, then that's not something that should be struck under Daubert. But if he employed the wrong methodology, then it absolutely is something that is questionable under Daubert.
Let me try.
Okay.
Okay. There are two things I'd like to mention.
You may need all that time after all, huh?
I may. We still have 16 minutes. Thank you, Judge Shaw, for accommodating.
You're welcome. There
are two points to be made. One is that would somebody have paid this much money for this functionality? I submit there's ample evidence in the record to show that somebody would have.
Somebody? But everybody?
Well, let me give you the evidence to show you why I think a reasonable conclusion could be made that anyone who used this functionality would fit in this category. You can reject it, but I'd like to just make the point. One is that the argument was made that the XML functionality was just a small, tiny, obscure functionality of Word, and maybe even a tiny, obscure functionality of XML itself. But we pointed out in our red brief that, and this is clear at 7684, Microsoft touted the XML as a core functionality core technology to Word. I don't think they use the word core, but the words they used are equivalent. It was very important functionality to Word. And that a custom XML was, and this is a quote, was the most important effort it did on XML in Office since ever. And that's at 7565. There are several key Microsoft documents. And one is at 7684, and one is at 7291. 7684, it says, Microsoft has truly embraced XML as a key component of our company-wide strategy going forward. Office 11, which is Word 2003, will lead the way in delivering the benefits of XML to the desktop productivity customer. Then at 7291, it says, if we're betting the farm on the XML revolution, an XML editor should be an absolutely fundamental component of our product system. And then there's another document at also at 7291, and I will mention that that one was directed directly to Bill Gates. That one says, an XML authoring tool would be a logical new product for MS. If Word was to morph in an XML direction, that would refresh that product and provide one more reason for users to upgrade. And in fact, Microsoft at one point did sell an upgrade. It was the SGML author, and they sold it for over $500. And so there's a lot of evidence. In fact, I can get you, hopefully I can get you that site.
Now, what was it they sold for over $500 that you were just
an SGML author, it was called. And we mention it in our brief. Do you have a site for that? It's at A1388 to 1390. So there are all kinds of reasons why.
And did that, might have missed this. Did this SGML author offer XML technology? Is
yes.
That what it was?
Yes. So.
But even if I were to grant you everything that you've just said as completely gospel and beyond question, all of it goes to the notion that Microsoft thought, and possibly consumers too, that the XML portion of Word were important. And suppose I were to actually concede something I'm sure Mr. Powers never would and say that every single person who used the XML technology bought Word solely for that purpose. Okay. Still, the Word product ranged from, what, $90 in some cases to $200-something in others. Not all those people, not everyone who's willing to pay $90 for something or $200 is willing to pay $500 for it.
Well, I submit that they sold this SGML author for over $500 per unit.
Yeah, but the problem you have here with damages, and I'm wondering if it's methodology or not, such that I should exclude, is I don't disagree that some people are willing to pay $500. The problem is that your expert assumed that everyone who bought Word was willing to alternatively buy the $500 product. And we both know not all those people are. I mean, I go to the supermarket, and if the price of asparagus is more than $3.99 a pound, I don't buy it. Sometimes I, you know, go, and even if I want it for dinner tonight, I don't buy it.
Well, I can only tell you that the people bought the X Metal, and there is evidence, and I will direct you to it, A1468 at 7-10, line 7-10, and you'll have to read the words because there's a typo here, and it's a typo on an important word, but I think it can only be read one way. The words are that the additional functionalities in XMetal, it says, are totally and necessary. That doesn't make any sense. And in the context, it clearly means are totally unnecessary. So you have an XMetal product, which sold for $499, which had a lot of functionalities. And he said, it's totally unnecessary if you use it as an add-on to Word. So you have a unit that is sold ex metal. It's sold for $499, which people are buying. Mr. Power said it has to be an infringing use. It doesn't have to be an infringing use to be a benchmark. There's no law that says it has to be infringing use. There has to be some relevant reason, some rational reason for picking it. And I gave you the relevant rational reason for picking it. But the point is, if you have an X-metal unit which sells for $499, which is, or is it $399? $499. Which was the cheapest one of the alternatives that he could have picked, the cheapest one, and it has a functionality which people want to use, and the other functionalities are really not necessary as an add-on to Word, it is not unreasonable to assume that somebody who wanted to have that functionality would have been willing to make that payment. And what he did was he took the 25% rule and he ended up with $96, and I think based on other factors it ended up being $98.
What about that 25% rule?
Your Honor?
Why is that not just something pulled out of the air that we ought to be willing to accept as a methodology?
The 25% rule is a factor, is used all the time in patent infringement cases. There are some people who don't like it, and Dr. Wagner admitted there are some people who don't like it. But there are a lot of people who do like it, and in fact, this court's decisions, they're cited in our red brief, have sustained analyses under the 25% rule. It is a rational approach. The jury heard it. They heard the attacks on the 25% rule because Microsoft's expert said poo-pooed it, said he didn't like it. And so the jury, again, had an opportunity to decide. Certainly, the 25% rule in the abstract is not a basis for throwing out or for applying the Daubert rule. 25% rule is used all the time and is proper. And maybe the jury shouldn't have accepted it, but they did accept it in this case, and there was countervailing testimony on that subject.
Would you mind if I moved you on to willfulness? You guys want damages questions? Okay. I think Mr. Powers raised a point that I'd like to hear your response to, which is we're not talking about introducing the re-exam evidence for invalidity, but simply on the issue of willfulness. Why wouldn't the PTO's rejection of the very claims that have been found to infringe in this case be enough to give credibility to their defense as a valid defense to prevent willfulness?
Simply for this reason, Your Honor, there has been no response from I4I in that re-examination. So you have an examination so far which has been based on the input of one party. Secondly, the standard of review in the Patent Office, which is construing claims as broadly as reasonably possible, is very different from the standard of review in the district courts. And thirdly, there is case law from this court, which has held, I believe it's from this court, which has held reasonable, not relying on a re-examination early office action because its value is greatly exceeded by the prejudicial effect to a jury.
Right, but why not for willfulness, though? Why isn't it something that gives credibility to a defense, not meaning to legitimize it such that it should be adopted, but simply as a defense to willfulness? It's sort of like not for the truth of the matter asserted, but rather just to give credibility to the fact that they did have a good faith belief walking into this, that they were not willfully infringing someone else's patent rights.
Your Honor, for the reasons I mentioned, one, the fact that the Patent Office has acted without any input from us is not a good measure of whether or not that's a reasonable, something reasonable to be relied on by the other side, particularly in a situation where there's a different standard of review. I submit, certainly, it's not a basis for throwing out a whole verdict on the ground, certainly not an abuse of discretion. The question is, did the district court abuse his discretion, or its discretion, by not admitting that evidence? I think there are ample reasons. People can disagree on whether or not the district court judge should have done it, but abuse of discretion is a very high threshold to reach, and I don't think it was reached in this case. Now,
can, Do you want to talk more on willfulness, or can I move? I'm going to move you right along if you don't mind.
No, please, go ahead.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you a question about the injunction in this case.
Yes.
The court asked for some supplemental evidence or information from the parties regarding the record proof establishing what the district court said in his order with regard to the injunction. It seems clear from the language of his order that he intended to give Microsoft the amount of time it would reasonably take them to design around the patent in this case, namely 5 months, is what they said. He ultimately gave them 90 days, and he said in that order, there is some conflicting evidence over how long it will reasonably take Microsoft to do that, therefore I'm going to give them 60 days. Well, so we asked the parties to submit what evidence it was that supported the notion that something other than 5 months, because his order very clearly cites the evidence, the testimony that it would take them 5 months, but it actually cites nothing in the way of conflicting evidence. And unfortunately, I couldn't find any conflicting evidence that you all presented to us on the issue of how long it would take them to design around. Not whether they're capable of it, not how they would go about doing it, but how long, the amount of time. I found no testimony that conflicted the 5 month notion. So I guess my question to you is, since isn't that a clear error by the district court, because he clearly intended in the order to give them at least the amount of time that was reasonable for them, and so isn't it an error on his part because it turns out there's no conflicting evidence that conflicts with the 5 months?
Your Honor, the answer to that on this subject, because as I was not at the trial, but we discussed this. When the court asked us for information, we gave you all the information
right.
we could find. And Microsoft responded with a very short letter, quote, there is none, close quote. So we didn't give you a ton. I agree, we did not give you a ton. And they said there is none. And the fact is...
But they said there is none to support your notion that a shorter time period
yes,
would be adequate. They certainly didn't need to present us because the district
court decided
exactly
right.
the 5 months.
Exactly
right. Yeah.
I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. The fact is that that issue was not... that issue was not terribly well debated in terms of how much time there was. Because if I recall correctly, I for I said, no time, let's have an immediate injunction.
Yeah, well, yes, of course.
Yeah. And the court, in its wisdom, decided, no, I'm going to give some time. We had a couple of amicus briefs, you'll recall, Your Honor, which said more time is needed. If in the wisdom of this panel, for sure we have very good arguments that an injunction should have been entered. And if the court is interested, I will explain that. But you're asking a different question. Assuming the injunction is sustained, how much lead time should they have? Our point was they've had plenty of time already from the time infringement was found to make a change. And by the time the court's decision is over, they will have had even more time. And that may be more than enough time for them to make the change. But if in the court's wisdom, the court feels that 60 days is not enough, even from the time you render your decision, then we will defer to whatever reasonable time you conclude. Alternatively, if you otherwise sustain the decision and remand to the district court, you might want to remand with an instruction to the district court to have a brief hearing or briefs exchanged on that issue and to make a subsequent decision based on that. So,
can I ask one final question?
And
that's on the, and I guess I want to, you know, tap your recollection even given that we've noted that you were one of the parties in the Reed Corporation. So I'm talking about Reed and the use of the district court of litigation misconduct as a measure for enhancing damages at $40 million. I guess my two questions are, one, do you think that Seagate Reed, as I understand it, tell me if I'm wrong, doesn't allow litigation misconduct to be the be-all and end-all, but it does allow it to be one factor. But I also think one could read Reed as putting limitations on the kind of litigation misconduct we're talking about, because they refer to manipulative litigation strategy, which demonstrates a lack of good faith belief in its defenses. So one, do you agree that you have to meet that criteria to be covered by Reed and to be a permissible factor an enhancement? And two, do you think that Seagate undermined that portion of Reed?
Okay. I don't think Seagate under... I know Reed pretty well because it was my case, which I fortunately won. I don't think Seagate undermines that factor. The Reed factor are... They list, I think, 9 factors that the court should consider in determining whether to enhance. So this isn't a question, the jury doesn't end up hearing this, the judge makes the decision. One of the factors is conduct at, I don't remember the exact words, you said them, conduct of the party at the litigation. We have a situation here where the district court judge admonished Mr. Powers and said, I suggest you not do that. During the voir dire, certain questions were asked about bankers and trolls and people who don't practice and what have you, and he ended up repeating it. And I think that the court under Reed properly took that into consideration. It is expressly listed as one of the factors in Reed, and I think it survives Seagate. I don't think it undermines Seagate at all. Because Seagate was concerned.
Seagate repeatedly emphasizes pre-litigation conduct.
Right.
And they say, absent some extraordinary circumstances, I read Seagate, the reliance entirely is on the pre-litigation conduct.
Right.
And doesn't that undermine the notion that this kind of conduct at trial would be relevant to making the determination of willfulness?
It doesn't, because the purpose of Seagate was to... You did say Seagate.
Yes.
Yeah. The purpose of Seagate... The willfulness had gotten out of hand. When juries heard bad things about a party, many of them instinctively found willfulness. And I read Seagate, emanating from a concurring opinion by Judge Dyke, where he cited some Supreme Court rule about objective willfulness, as an attempt to pull back, to put some reins on the willfulness doctrine. That is not the same issue involving enhancement. Enhancement is a judge decision. It's a judge decision based on the totality of circumstances. It includes financial considerations. It includes misconduct. It includes a lot of other things. And I think that all survives. I think the philosophy behind Seagate is very different from the philosophy behind Reed, and therefore, that's my best answer, Your Honor. And I see that I have been a bad predictor.
No, that's all right, Mr. Dunn. We had a number of questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr.